Hello and welcome to this edition of the BullishTest.com political podcast. From BullishTest.com, I'm Matt Bowler. This time around, we sat down with Brad Kierkegaard, religious studies professor from San Diego State. And no, he's not a relation of the famous 19th century philosopher. We talked Pope. This is our Pope-tastic podcast. I kind of like the alliteration there. The Pope is making waves inside and outside the church. We talked about how Brad is understanding the Pope's views on what the Catholic Church should be focused on. Pope has made some waves talking about focusing on the poor over birth control and homosexuality, his criticism on global capitalism. The Pope even came out in favor of breastfeeding, even though we didn't talk about that. I waited as long as I did to talk about the Pope because I wanted to give him a chance to do something. To do something worth talking about. People knew about him, you know, he was the cardinal from Buenos Aires, from Argentina. And people had kind of an idea about him, but they didn't know how this Jesuit was going to act in that office. Brad had some really great insight about this Pope, and I particularly like the way he compared this Pope with Pope Emeritus Benedict. That was kind of interesting. We were in the chapel, little chapel behind the altar at St. Joseph's Cathedral in downtown San Diego. It's over on 3rd Avenue. It's a cathedral's been around, as a cathedral, I think it's been around since the 1940s. But there's been a Catholic church at that location since early 19th century. I'm guessing from what I remember from reading about it, was 1840 was when the first church was built on that site. So Brad has a great way of kind of couching even his criticisms sort of in positivity. So he's critical, but he's kind of optimistic about his criticism. It's a very interesting way of approaching anything in general, I think. I kind of found that to be an interesting aspect of our conversation. So, and as always, if you want to chime in on this Pope-tastic political podcast or you've got anything else you want to chime in on, feel free. Just give us a call, 619-663-4531, 619-663-4531. And please remember to post, repost, and share. And now for the Pope-tastic BullishTest.com political podcast. Enjoy.
Or two, just because I feel like it's work. And if I'm not wearing a tie, I'm just hanging out.
Exactly.
I don't know,
exactly.
Something in my head that just doesn't click.
Yeah.
But no, it's very nice. So we're here at St. Joseph's, which is downtown, the cathedral, downtown San Diego. San Diego's cathedral is not USD. A lot of people think it's the Immaculata at USD, but it's not. It's downtown on 3rd Street. 3rd and, I believe this is Ash?
I think so.
It's like 3-something 3rd Street.
Yep.
So, old Spanish style, built well over 100 years, I think 200 years ago. There's this cool animation they have where this guy took, and they've got pictures of the cathedral from the same angle every year since before it was built.
Wow.
And so he kind of built this animation around it, and you see the streets being paved and growing and telephone poles going in and other buildings being built around it.
Wow.
So it's just fascinating to see that this building actually survived that long in San Diego.
Sure.
Because normally they don't.
No, they really do not. And to see the city literally grow up around it, which is what's supposed to happen with churches.
It's pretty amazing. And ironically, I live in an old Presbyterian church downtown, also that was converted into apartments.
That's great. Which didn't make it. There
which
you go.
Which didn't make it. It's apartments. And right next door to it is an old Baptist church, which is now a theater.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's weird. This is like this row of church old churches right on 10th Avenue there.
Yeah.
That are all now something else.
You see that in a lot of cities. These churches, I know I lived for years in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Lots of empty churches that they're, you know, figuring out, what do you do with them? You turn them into nightclubs, turn them into...
My wife and I want to buy one.
Do you?
And just turn it into, imagine just turn one big family room up front, a kitchen in the back.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And then you can stick all the mother-in-laws and father-in-laws upstairs in one of the little hidden rooms.
I love it.
Yeah.
No, they're great spaces and such amazing history. And well, it's also a great commentary on the changing life of the church, that so many of these traditions have lost members and lost also their urban connection.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of great way of circling back into what we're here to talk about, which is the new Pope. He's new by, I guess, Catholic standards, which are geological time. Catholics long.
Exactly. The long durée.
Yeah. So he's still considered a freshman pope, right?
Yes.
10 years he'll be into his junior year.
Exactly.
But right now he's very popular, mm-hmm. gaining a lot of popularity in the United States, I think.
Yeah.
People are amazed, especially Catholics that are on the left. Yes. They feel like, oh, finally there's a pope that I can identify with.
I'm seeing a lot of that on the left. He's amazingly popular with the center, too, with the kind of main body of the church, the kind of conservative Catholics, if you will. And even the traditionalists aren't complaining that much.
Some are. But I mean, the thing is it's hard for them because he's got the credentials.
He does.
Because he's a Jesuit, so he's studied, he's educated.
He is.
And that's always, I think, a lot of problems that a lot of parish priests have is that they're not nearly as educated as a lot of these Dominican or Jesuits
are. That's true.
That brings a lot of gravity to what he's saying.
It does.
And so what are people going to do? How are they? How do you respond? What do you do? Like what Rush Limbaugh has been doing, which is just complaining about...
Sure. Which Rush is known to do, of course.
Yeah. I mean, and nobody takes him seriously.
Right.
He's like a political clown at this point.
Yeah. Well, I think also Pope Francis has been very careful when he does say things that are challenging to some of the people on the conservative side of things, I should say the traditional side of things with the Catholic Church, with how he frames it. And he frames it in biblical language. He frames it within, the tradition of the church.
So that they don't have as much to...
What do you complain about?
How do they report?
About.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, like this last thing that got everybody up in an uproar was the capitalism comment.
Right. Right.
And a lot of people on the right are still very angry about this because they see this as blatantly anti-capitalistic, and which they think is anti-American, which they're confused by because for them, the Pope is somebody that identified with Ronald Reagan and his attack on communism and pro-capitalism.
Yep.
But I don't think they ever understood the church's real relationship with regard to the economy.
Well, and the church has a different perspective, and I think that that's hard for... I mean, on the one hand, Americans are very excited. Here's a great Pope, a superstar Pope. And I think that the left, I mean, I gather Obama, quoted a bit of him.
I think
he quoted that brief
Obama's
piece.
Not really left-wing at all. I don't see Obama's left-wing.
No,
I see him as very centrist.
Centrist within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, yeah.
So centrist within...
Depends on how far right you are, right?
Exactly. And at some point, I mean, libertarian, you go far enough left and you're right again.
Come back.
Exactly. So I think the political landscape in America is an interesting thing. But I think both sides kind of want to look to this Pope because he is a superstar, and they want to see something to claim. And so, on the one hand, Obama wants to quote him. On the other hand, I think I saw a piece in Forbes where they were saying, what the Pope's really asking for is more Bill Gates, more really rich people who then choose to give.
Yeah. That's always the thing, right? Sure. That does seem to be, right? And we should choose to be, but...
And frankly, it's neither. I mean, I think that really what it is that it's in the language of the church, which is... Totally different language. It's not all of these economic systems are problematic from a religious perspective, from Christianity, which has a totally different worldview.
So explain that. Kind of explain that.
Sure.
Where he's coming from.
Great.
What you think?
Well, I think first of all, to back up a tiny bit, I think one of the things people have to appreciate with somebody like Pope Francis, and with frankly any pope, is I think that there's a hope and an expectation that maybe he's going to suddenly change everything.
That
suddenly he's going to come along and rewrite the whole history of things.
I got to say, it's mostly Protestants that seem to feel this way.
Exactly.
It's almost like they're looking for that pope that's going to make them want to convert to Catholicism.
Sure. Sure. No,
which is funny.
It is. No, I think you're right. And I think there probably are some people in the pews within the Catholic Church who also want to see things radically changed. Whether it's traditionalists who wanted to suddenly go back to the Latin Mass, people who are on the far liberal side of the Catholic Church, wanting to keep on the spirit of Vatican II, ordain women, suddenly ordain gay clergy. I don't think either is really likely to happen anytime soon. Mm-hmm. Popes, they inherit the life of the church. They inherit the rich history. They inherit the rich tradition. Mm-hmm. They have an opportunity then to draw out all of these different elements within the rich life of the church, which is far richer and far more complex than most people appreciate.
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing with Pope Francis is he's drawing on some of that language and drawing on it in ways that surprise people, challenge expectations. So this economic thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm a professor. I can't help it. Everything's threaded and interrelated.
Well, no, you have to take a humanistic kind of approach to all of these things in order to really understand them, because, religion affects economy, science affects religion. I'm saying those things aren't all interlinked is foolish.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
And so my specialty is especially early Christianity. That's mm-hmm. my research specialty. And so the church, understandably, is always looking back to that early period. Whether you're Catholic, whether mm-hmm. you're Protestant, whether you're Eastern Orthodox, you're always looking back to that early formative period of Jesus, of the first apostles, of the early church and its first couple generations. Mm-hmm. And in that early Christianity story, what we see are a couple economic models. We see in Luke Acts this ideal of everything held in common, that everybody kind of pooled all their resources together and there was enough.
So Luke was a communist.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, and probably even a socialist or even, mm-hmm. a step. Yeah, I mean, for him, everything is shared in common.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Gospel of Luke, how it presents Jesus, Jesus is the champion of the poor.
Yeah.
Blessed are you poor. Woe to you who are rich.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's easier for a poor man to get into heaven than it is for a camel to thread a needle.
Exactly. Kind of thing, yeah. And so, that's woven throughout the entire Gospel.
Or, it's easier for a poor man to get in heaven than it is for a camel. Well, of course it is. But then for a rich man to compare a rich man to as a camel threading a needle.
Exactly.
There we go. I know. I shortened my metaphor there, and it'd be totally confusing anybody that wasn't aware
of the full reference.
Of the
there.
Full reference there.
Exactly.
It'd be lost. What is this camel? What is he talking about?
And even the other Gospels don't do that. So, for instance, Gospel of Matthew, the same passages. Blessed are the poor in spirit.
Yeah.
And so different way of seeing this. But for Luke, it's poor. It's economic.
Yeah. Why do you think Luke had that? Was it when that was written? Is it more reflective of the political times?
I think it is. I mean, I think that Christianity, it didn't have a single economic model, but Luke Acts was clearly one of the strong economic models. Mm-hmm. And his vision of the church, based partly on his understanding of the Holy Spirit, was that everything was shared. And you see that in the early community in Acts, that the Holy Spirit descends, they share everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Heaven forbid that you not. So you get that great story of, I think it's Ananias and Sapphira, who sell some land, and they bring part of it to the church. Mm. But they hold some back.
Yeah, yeah.
They lie about how much they sold it for. And so what happens now? But the husband, as he does so, he falls over dead, and he gets dragged out. And no sooner does he do so, but the wife comes in, and she lays down the portion, and she's clearly in collusion, and she then falls over dead right after him. Clear reminder here, you hold nothing back from the church.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's Luke Acts' vision of it,
mm-hmm.
and that model definitely exists. Paul's churches don't look like that.
Yeah.
Paul's churches, clearly there are rich and poor, there are economic problems. He even describes in 1 Corinthians there are problems with the church, that people are gathering for the meal, and they're gathering at a time of day that the rich people are coming, they're eating all the good food, and the poor people have to work, they don't get there in time.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are clearly economic and social divisions. So you have both models in the early church, but the Luke Acts thing really carries on a life.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this ideal within Christianity that all things are shared.
Yeah.
And so I think there's this language then that later Christians continue to draw on, even as it doesn't necessarily work out that way, because of course the church finds its place in the world. There are rich people. Kings don't give up all their money.
Yeah, yeah, of course not.
The aristocrats don't suddenly give everything over. And so I think, again, Pope Francis now has this opportunity to draw on that language of sharing and of equality. And, I mean, it's there. It's in the Bible.
Yeah.
It's in Luke Acts.
It's kind of an easy get in a lot of ways, right?
It is. It is.
But why do you think other popes haven't done it in the same way that he has now?
I think that's a great question. I think each pope draws on different things. And that's what you see, is each draws on different little parts of the church. Trying to think if we've ever seen a pope who's really drawn on it.
I mean, pre-John Paul, who was that, Pius?
Yeah, you've got, is it Pius the VI, I think?
Something like, yeah, and he's the one that did Vatican II.
Correct.
And then he died
in the
suddenly.
Correct, in the midst of all of that.
Mysteriously, and there's conspiracy theories around that, which isn't a rabbit hole I want to go down.
Fair enough, and probably not one I could comment on very well.
It's like a Kennedy assassination rabbit hole you can just keep going down. But, how would he, because he's sort of the closest, more contemporary as far as style, right? I mean, as far as kind of the content that he's putting up, because he wanted to open the church up, open the light. That was his big thing, right?
He did. He did.
And then he brought in Vatican II, which was still very controversial.
It's still controversial, and I think the church is still kind of adapting to
all of the changes. There's a lot of parishes that just didn't adopt a lot of the changes of Vatican II and still haven't.
Yep.
And I think even in San Diego, there's some parishes that are considered kind of liberal that have adopted all of the changes of Vatican II.
And some that have resisted parts.
Some that just simply haven't, and it has to do more with the parish and the priest and what he thinks his parishioners will accept, I think.
Yeah.
And that's a relationship that I don't think a lot of people understand too, right? Well, there's kind of this political relationship between parish priests and their flock and
there
the Pope and the cardinals and the priests. And
there is. And I think all of the Catholic religious landscape is defined by Vatican II today.
Yeah.
There's no question. How do you relate to Vatican II?
Yeah.
And I think this is also part of the reason he's unlikely to innovate too far, that frankly the church is still dealing with Vatican II.
Yeah.
Do you really want to shake things up when...
Well, for him to implement those changes is seen as radical enough, right?
Yeah.
Because they were kind of ignored for a long time in a lot of ways.
I think both Pope John Paul II and Benedict, in their way, were implementing Vatican II.
Interesting.
But I think the question is which parts and how did they interpret it? Both of them were there. Benedict was even called on as an expert, a theological expert for it.
Well, they're all smart guys.
That's sort of the thing.
Even if you disagree with them for whatever reason... You're not going to say that they're not scholars. I don't think anybody gets elected pope who isn't a scholar. I mean, in this day and age.
In this day and age,
you're not going to get somebody who's just like, your whatever rich Medici stepson was out there.
Sure.
These days, not. It doesn't work that way.
Or whatever person a king sets up, the king of France chooses. I think we've been very fortunate in that we've had kind of one superstar pope after another, frankly. I mean, I know Benedict...
He wasn't nearly as popular.
He was not as beloved. But speaking as an academic,
oh really?
Benedict was pretty amazing. I mean, here's a guy who's brilliant. I mean, brilliant theologian. Yeah. One of the greatest minds, you know, of the church, who, granted, you know, could he connect that to people? That's another issue.
Yeah. maybe it was because he's German.
Possible.
They're just not connecting friendly. I mean, John Paul, kind of maybe it's just like a personal thing. It's a human being thing at that point.
Well, and also, how do you follow John Paul II, who was so beloved
and
was pope for so very long?
Uh-huh.
And in some ways, Benedict was a perfect kind of between with what comes now with Pope Francis. He kind of, you know, cleared the way for another very charismatic pope.
Do you think a lot of people have been tossing around the idea that, because it didn't take many elections for him to get elected, right?
Correct.
And
correct.
So, I know at least in the newsroom when we were waiting for him to get elected, you know, everybody's glued to
him. Yeah, we were. Yeah.
It was exciting.
It was.
It's like watching a presidential, and I get excited about politics. So
sure.
That's my football is politics.
Yeah, understandable. And church politics is wild.
Yeah. It's just so rich.
It is.
But it seems like cardinals all went in, and then maybe... They voted once, and they kind of all voted for who they thought they were supposed to vote for, maybe once or twice.
Right.
And then they were on their third ballot, and they kind of, you know what? And everybody just kind of collectively decided to vote for who they think should be pope.
Yeah.
And then that's how Francis got elected. And none of them thought it was actually going to happen. They were just kind of doing it once, and then it was like,
wow.
oh, crap, we just elected this guy, and we really didn't mean to because he didn't navigate that political landscape nearly in the same way.
No.
So he's totally a shock in a lot of ways.
I think that's very possible, and certainly was very fast. I mean, I think I remember I was in the midst of that with you in the newsroom stuff, and none of us expected it. None of us expected it to be that fast. All the commentators were expecting several days.
At least this
is typical, is that, you know, there's some back and forth, there's some, you know, who should it really be, factions forming. You know, it was fast. And, of course, I think there's a fair amount of suggestion that maybe he had been a close runner-up when Benedict was chosen. And it shows.
But nobody ever knows.
You don't.
Does the Vatican keep those ballots for history?
They do, I gather.
In 100 years, we can go look and see who came in second.
I don't know if they're ever open to us.
I would love to see who came in second in the 1900s, right?
Wouldn't it be fascinating to see? They do, I think, keep the books. And I remember, oh, goodness, it was There was actually a papal exhibit that that traveled and came here to San Diego.
Okay.
I was at the museum, and it had all of the bits and pieces of papal trappings, including the hammer that they hit your head with, and, the books of notes that the people had kept and things, because you weren't allowed to look at them. But it had all of the kind of bits of ceremony, and it came and was here at the Museum of Art. And I remember my wife and I looking at each other and thinking, you know, Pope John Paul II is pretty old. Do they have another hammer? You know, what happens here if something goes wrong, right?
Yeah.
But they did have things like the, I believe they did actually have a lot of the reflections and maybe even the ballads.
Interesting.
Which, of course, I think they do this funky stitching them together.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very interesting.
Yeah, they referenced that in the Borgia series.
That's right. They did, yes. Yeah, which, of course, was a wonderful depiction of a messier version.
Yeah, yeah. A more interesting version of
it. It was. Politics in another fashion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That whole era, though. I mean, that's just fascinating.
It is. It is.
So, and this Pope also was really controversial when he said just to stop wasting your time obsessing over gays and birth control.
Yes, yes.
First off, kind of explain the context of how he said that, and then is the American media kind of overblowing what he said in a way, or are we giving it enough weight or undervaluing it? Or?
Right, the wrong.
All
right, so I'm trying to remember that particular quote. I know the one that I see most often, which is the quote about homosexuality, where he says, you know, that if a person is gay and if they're seeking the Lord and of good, what does he say?
He kind of,
good intent or something, then who am I to judge?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That one, I believe, was on an airplane. I think he was on his way back from, like, the World Youth conference or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the one where he says basically we're all obsessing too much.
I'm
trying to remember the context for it. Was it an interview with the Jesuit
magazine? I think it was an interview, and I read it, and it came in whatever the Vatican has their publication put out. Yeah, yeah.
Right. And all of these, I think, it's interesting. What I keep seeing in the news is everybody loves to grab these snippets, right? And Obama, when they grabbed a snippet for his speech, I think it was the bit about how that when an elderly person, you know, dies of exposure, you know, how is that not in the news? Whereas when the stock market ticks up or down 2 points, that everybody gets all excited about it.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, that this is horrifying, that this is wrong. This is morally wrong. And I think everybody loves to grab snippets. He has these great kernels. He does.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
very quotable. This is a very quotable pope.
Jesuits are really media savvy, though. That's
they
the
are.
Thing that a lot of people
No,
don't
I think you're probably right.
I feel like, you know, I got to tell you, that in a newsroom, you will find so many people that study with Jesuits.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's very common. It's
interesting.
Very common. Yeah, yeah.
So they're very intentionally media aware?
I think they came around with the printing press.
Interesting.
Kind of that whole spreading the word of God thing is part of their, so using the
media
and being a media savvy and being aware of, as a collective consciousness, what that means, I think, is something that a lot of people
even in their creation, that they were created as people to kind of hold the doctrine and to present it, and they were really employed in many ways to balance the spread of Protestantism and the quality of their teaching and in their personal example.
Yeah, they just, they seem very media savvy. There's a lot of Jesuits with Twitter accounts.
Really?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know many Dominicans with Twitter accounts.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know I know of a lot of Jesuits with Twitter accounts and a lot of Jesuits that pay attention to the media a lot more than I think other orders do.
Well, and they know their doctrine, they know their teaching, they're very careful with what they say and how they say it. And I think.
So he's not being flippant when he says, because he knows people pay attention to every word that he says. You know, you can't have like an obnoxious pope. It would be funny, but you couldn't have one. Right.
I don't think he's flippant at all, but I think one of these that's very interesting, and I think the balance between his words and his actions are very interesting with this pope. And I think that this is a pope who, on the one hand, is very careful about what he does. He's also very impulsive. He's very, he's a person who is so compassionate, so empathetic, that he seems to do these things very spontaneously.
Yeah.
That, you know, granted, some of the stuff, I'm sure, is very staged, whether it's the embracing of the man with the horrible skin disease.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or the little kid on stage.
Sure. But then others of these, you look at him in these pictures holding a baby, and the joy that's lighting up his face, his reaction, that's not staged. That's just, it's just not. And you can see, I think part of what is so capturing everybody with this Pope is these impulsive, momentary, these spontaneous things that, you know, driving the Popemobile and he sees a friend and he stops it, he picks him up.
Yeah.
Right?
But he's not even really in the Popemobile anymore. He's in that used Peugeot that's giving to him.
Exactly.
I mean, that's another, people look at that and he seems to be more leading by example.
He is.
Than
he
less is. Telling people how to live.
He is.
Whereas I think that's a big contrast between Benedict and
a
and
huge
Francis.
Contrast.
You know, Benedict was saying help the poor, but meanwhile he's in $1,000 Prada shoes.
Exactly.
Which was a problem for a lot of Catholics.
No, I think so. And you know, granted, I think there are lots of people within the church, lots of even popes in the past for which, again, that fits.
Yeah, of course.
Lots of academics who are, you know, preaching poverty while we're not necessarily living that.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think this is a Pope whose actions match his words completely.
And at least so far.
So far, exactly. And whose actions maybe even speak louder than his words, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And I think, again, he chose well when he chose the name Francis. Mm-hmm. That of all people, if you're going to look for a person in the Catholic Church whose actions spoke much louder than his words, mm-hmm. Francis was a man of action. He was a man who was very impulsive, who did things that shocked people.
Yeah.
That startled people.
They tried to excommunicate him how many times while he was alive and failed? Like two or three, I think?
Francis was a very messy figure, and I love...
And they were able to do it after he died.
Well,
I think that's how I remember. I could totally be wrong.
I'm not...
But I'm thinking he had to defend himself.
He's right on the border, I think it's fair to say. And I think that you look at the people leading into him, the Waldensians, lots of people who were proclaimed heretics, whose ideas were frankly no more radical than Francis's.
Yeah.
And I always look back to that. The Pope at the time was a guy named Innocent III. Innocent III was the most powerful Pope in the entire history of the Church.
Yeah.
And here was a guy who played kings off of one another like they were chess pieces. He was as engaged in the world as any Pope could ever be. And suddenly you get Francis. Mm-hmm. Francis with 11 followers showing up for a papal audience saying, you know, what do you think? Am I doing this right? And you have to imagine how this could have gone.
Yeah.
And of course, the story, the legend is that he has this vision, he has this dream that the church is toppling, mm-hmm. and here's one lone monk holding it up, mm-hmm. one lone person holding the weight of the church, keeping it from falling, from crumbling. And of course, he has this as he's reflecting on what to do with Francis.
Mm-hmm.
And this now is why he embraces the order and why he then gives them, gives this opportunity. And of course, they become so popular.
Yeah.
But you have to imagine that Francis, I mean, in so many ways, he challenged everything that the church had been and was by living this simple life of absolute poverty, mm-hmm. By challenging all of the church teachings of the day, and was in so many ways way more radical than Pope Francis is.
Yeah.
But again, what a perfect name to choose.
Yeah.
To then shake things up a little bit.
Well, yeah, and it also showed Italians that he was kind of...
Sure.
I may not be Italian because he's the first, New World Pope since... I mean, I don't think... he's the first New World Pope, but he's the first non-Italian Pope in 1,000-something years.
Well, non-European, exactly. Non-European. And prior to Pope John Paul II, who was, I think, the first one in something like 500 years...
Yeah, and that wasn't
even those terms Italian. Get strange. I know people with Benedict that were trying to say, you know, the first pope to step down in 600 years. Really, he's kind of the first ever to do so in the way he was, because all of the examples are so extreme. Likewise, I haven't looked to see the first non-European pope, quote-unquote. Yeah. My guess is it's back during a period where it's kind of meaningless. I mean, if it's in the Roman Empire and they're from North Africa, what does that mean?
That kind of thing. Yeah.
I mean, what does it really mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's pretty amazing, too.
It is. Nowadays.
And when he was first elected, my wife helped with ABC News and their research into him in Argentina.
Uh-huh.
They called everyone in Argentina. It was pretty.
Yeah.
She spent hours on the phone just trying to, because there was a lot of rumors about his role during Argentina's dirty war.
Sure, especially with those two Jesuits.
Yeah. Then it turned out that those two priests come out and say, no. If it wasn't for him, I still would have been in that. Engineering school turned. Prison or whatever it was.
Sure. Well, so many of those people disappeared and were never
just
found.
Vanished.
Yeah. People, the lost.
Yeah. And so it was nice in a lot of ways to see, because how people could really dig into his past. Because even before that, you know, you couldn't. You could dig into World War II and Germany and all
right.
With Benedict, and there was still some controversy. Yes. From that time.
Yes.
And the Dirty War is similar. I think you can compare it in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It was kind of this mm-hmm. fascist uprising mm-hmm. in South America and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But to have him come out kind of not just clean, but like...
Praising him. Yes.
Is a whole different kind of... kind of a relief. And it's mm-hmm. kind of sad to say in a lot of ways that people would be relieved by that. I think Catholics everywhere were kind of holding their breath
sure.
and hoping that at least he would come out clean, but then he comes out and it turns out he was actually one of the good guys.
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, and it's... I mean, he's a remarkable figure. I mean, it's hard when you think of all the choices that he must have had to make.
Yeah. And it's never as black and white as people want to think it is.
It's not. And, you know. And you know, how do you deal... I mean, the
even,
church...
Even when you're talking about things as horrible as fascism, the situation, there's always these really ambiguous gray
there are.
Areas. You know, there I was are. Watching this movie called Lore about these kids who were the son, the daughter, the kids, the children of Nazi officers.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to them after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that process and how they were leading this, they had no idea what was going on. No. They were children.
Right, right.
And to them, their entire world collapsed, their parents disappeared, and,
yeah.
you know, now what?
Well, and even for many people living in Germany in the time, I gather, I mean, what do you do when that's the political landscape? How do you not participate in some form, and what
yeah.
does that look like?
Yeah, and if you don't participate, are you in right. danger?
Yep.
And then to come out as one of the good guys, which so means that he was actually probably actively in danger at the time, and it was only his profile that kept him from being
yes.
taken.
Yes.
I think says a lot for...
Well, in the church...
For him.
The church and all of these different religious officials, they have a long history of struggling. How do you fit in the world? How do you deal with
yeah.
these political systems? How do you respond to things that are unjust?
Particularly in South and Central America.
Definitely in an area like that, and especially yeah. with things like liberation theology, of course.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Really loaded
yeah.
issue, and one that I think, understandably, is an ongoing question for him, that on mm-hmm. the one hand, you know, it's been declared problematic or dangerous by the church, but clearly it's on the border,
yeah.
And I know that a lot of liberal Catholics really embrace liberation theology,
mm-hmm.
Or at least parts of it. And, you know, clearly parts of it do make sense, but then also are not acceptable. And
yeah, yeah.
you can see him kind of carefully treading that.
How do you think, and now I don't know if Francis is going to even be made aware of this. I'm sure he's aware of this, but I don't know how involved he's going to be. How do you think he would respond, if he was going to respond, to the nuns in Denver?
Hmm.
That you know what I'm talking about, these the nuns at the old folks home in Denver,
right,
that are suing because they're being required now under Obamacare to provide health care plans that meet federal minimum standards. And one of the aspects of the federal minimum standards is everyone has to have access to a basic minimum level of birth control.
Wow.
For free. But that's in the healthcare plan. It's not like these nuns are being forced to hand out condoms on the
sure,
street.
Sure, sure.
Or you know, they're not in that sense. And there are perfectly legitimate reasons for birth control that have absolutely nothing to do with whether or not you're going to have a child or not. Perfectly legitimate medical reasons for
yeah.
birth control, particularly for women.
Right,
that
right.
have absolutely nothing to do with whether preventing women from becoming pregnant.
Right.
Preventing cancer, pregnancies, and all kinds of stuff.
Are abortions built into that?
I think they may be, or
I think certain medical cases,
certain
they're
medical
built
cases,
in.
And access to the
exactly.
to them, through the healthcare plan.
I think that's the messier one than birth control.
Yeah. That definitely is the messier one than birth control.
Yeah,
but birth control is the one that's getting a lot of press.
Well,
for some
sure,
reason.
Sure. And, well, and that's the beginning of the dividing line,
yeah.
and then abortions further down.
Yeah.
Because
that's a legitimate surgical procedure for. Many different things, and that's the other thing. Now, they're a particular order. They run an old folks home, and they hire people
right.
who may or may not be Catholic.
Right.
I'm sure there are plenty of Jewish doctors that come
sure.
in there
sure.
all the time.
But then who choose to take those jobs working for a Catholic?
It's
an interesting,
still.
Yeah.
But they're suing so that, and this is preventing the Obamacare thing, and it's the one of the last, and ironically, Judge Sotomayor is the one who ordered the stay. I think the only Catholic on the Supreme Court.
Wow.
And she's the one who ordered the stay
wow.
On a Sunday. It's pretty funny.
Oh my gosh.
But she's considered to be, and she's an Obama nominee, and she's considered to be a Democrat, and very open-minded. But ordered this stay pending certain issue, pending the discovery of certain issues, pending the research into this, and possibly, they may possibly take on this decision. Now, whether or not it turns into one of these abstract legal arguments that I just won't get, or whether or not they actually deal with the issue
right
at hand is... That's something entirely different.
Well, for us, I can't hear, as a religious studies scholar, I can't hear that and not think, you know, free exercise of religion versus establishment and all of that. These are really big constitutional issues for us that I think do need to be wrestled with, first of all. So there probably is a legitimate legal issue there. Mm-hmm.
And they're approaching it from a separation of church state position, I believe. I could totally be wrong.
But that's
not
constitutional, actually.
Yeah. So I don't know.
That comes slightly after. It comes afterwards in the kind of reflections on the Constitution.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But the official piece is the free expression of religion versus establishment.
Yeah.
And those are seen as two things that have to be balanced, basically. And how you balance them really has been an ongoing
issue. Are they evangelizing through litigation?
Right. Or can you enforce religious people to go against their religious conscience by our law, and you can't.
Well, how come Orthodox Jews aren't suing that?
Yeah, this is an interesting question.
they don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that an opportunity, if you're Catholic, to choose, right? Isn't that part of the process, is that you are making this choice?
But if the government is removing, if they are going against a closely held belief, then you are allowed to raise a constitutional issue surrounding it.
But they're not saying you must have an abortion. I'm not saying you must use birth control. They're saying you must have the right to have access to these medical procedures.
And you must financially support it.
The insurance company must provide this coverage, yes.
Correct.
And these are federal mandatory.
And that you as an employer must support it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You as an employer must provide those things.
There's
some
issues. But so there are internal issues that I think are ours. But to go back to the question of the Pope, I
wonder how he would look at that.
I think, first of all, it's interesting to see that while he has been somewhat flexible, or flexible is maybe the wrong word, well, he has been very gracious in how he has responded to the question of homosexuality, even in how he's responded to the issue of women and their role in the church, although that's a messier topic.
Yeah.
When it comes to abortion,
this is a
no opener. I mean, there is no discussion here. This is not something for him that is to be, no, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, I think for all of these, how he's responding, he's looking to the language of the church.
Yeah.
So even abortion, what he does is he keeps turning it back to say what it's rooted in, this papal encyclical, I think it's Humanae Vitae, that was done in 1968, in the midst of the 60s, saying the sacredness of human life.
Yeah.
And so he's put that back and, you know, put it back to this issue of the value of human life. So I don't know. My guess is he would probably support it. I don't know that he would want to get involved. Because, I think there's that whole issue that you brought up earlier, that he has tried to shift the discussion. He said, let's not just focus on a couple issues. Let's stop focusing so much on homosexuality, on even topics like abortion. Let's focus instead on the poor. Let's focus on calling people to the life of the church.
It seems like he's saying, let's focus on doing the work instead of focus on preventing actions. It's like he's trying to take a positive approach instead of a negative approach.
Exactly right. And I've seen him use a lot for that in his speeches, as he talks about that love needs to be concrete, that it needs to be concretized in actions, that you need to do stuff. And let's stop, you know, trying to argue about all these little things. Let's focus on doing something. Let's focus on living out the gospel message.
How do you think that San Diego Catholics have been reacting?
That's a good question. I think my expectation is that churches are a little bit fuller everywhere, that everybody is listening a little bit more to the Pope. I'm curious. Americans, of course, have an interesting relationship with the Pope and how much they listen to or don't papal advice. And I think through all of this, the authority of the Pope is increasing in many ways, because people are listening to him. They're following what he says and what he does. I found it very interesting in the classroom So I teach, and of course I have lots of different students, some who are very overtly Christian, some who are very overtly atheist, Jewish, you know, the full range, and certainly some who are very overtly Catholic. And what's interesting to me to see is that the folk who are overtly Catholic, many of them are kind of lukewarm. You know, they grew up Catholic, they're not sure quite where they fit. College is a time you question things, you struggle, you figure out who you are. They definitely, you know, many of them still calling themselves Catholic, but they're not sure how Catholic they really are or aren't.
What that means.
Yeah, exactly. And what I'm hearing that I haven't heard in the history of since I've been teaching, certainly not with Benedict, and not always even with Pope John Paul II, is that many of them really are extremely fond of Pope Francis, that they're paying attention. And they talk about him in these kind of reverent tones. They talk about him in these very idealized sort
of
ways.
He seems likable.
He does.
He does seem likable.
He does. And in a way that they're relating to as the youth.
Yeah.
Which is, again, pretty remarkable. I mean,
I
don't know that they're his audience, but that they are picking up on this, I think, is a reminder of just how far he's reaching, that it's not just the news agencies, that it's not just the poor that he's reaching to, that it's not just people in South America, Latin America, but American wealthy college students are identifying with this. It's interesting to me to see his impact.
Yeah, I think in Argentina and most other countries in the world, right, when you get married, you have two ceremonies.
Right.
You have your civil ceremony, and then you have a religious ceremony, if you're religious.
Sure.
I think it's really only in the United States where we don't do that, where we let the whoever is marrying you, they can perform the marriage civilly or whatever it is.
Right.
So I think that clouds how Americans see marriage
it
in
does.
A lot of ways. And before, when Francis was cardinal, he came out in favor of gay civil unions, or at least wasn't totally outraged and opposed to them in a way. I mean, there was that period. And it wasn't like he was saying gays should get married, but at the same time, he was saying he wouldn't necessarily be opposed to it. I think that's how he phrased it. Something along those lines.
I think the context was that it was in Argentina. There was a lot of struggle over what to do with the situation from the life of the church. And he suggested possibly gay civil unions as a compromise.
Mm-hmm. And that would essentially be kind of half the ceremony. Now what I'm taking away from that isn't even the gay marriage issue.
Sure.
Is that he's living in an international community.
He is.
And Americans don't live in that international community.
No, we really don't.
We don't see, in every other country in the world, they have two ceremonies. And you know, the government sees marriage as this legal contract, it's this arrangement of ownership and how people are taxed.
Yeah.
And then there's the religious ceremony, which is seen as something totally separate, doesn't have any relation to the government and how the government, whether or not the government validates your marriage or not.
Mm-hmm.
And almost every New World country, I think, does that. Most of Western Europe, I think, does it that way, as I understand it, except for the United States.
That would make sense.
But that would gives him a much more international kind of perspective on things. And that, I think, is what's clouding his, or not clouding, but I think that's where Americans get confused when they try and relate to these big international figures, is that we don't have an international perspective on the world.
Sure. Well, even our response to these issues, these topics of capitalism, for instance, we assume that this is, you know, something the whole world, you know, follows, and even our brand of capitalism, or we think it should, even if they don't, right, that it's the best system. And, of course, that's not the world he speaks to.
Yeah,
And I think the Catholic Church, one of its great beauties is that it is a world church. Catholic, this term universal, in some ways it is a universal church. It's a worldwide church. It's also, of course, a challenge. How do you speak to so many different cultures? And I think the way he does is through the language of the history of the church. And then you hope it applies, that it's meaningful, and you make it meaningful, which I think, again, he's been very successful in doing.
Do you think there's a way do you think in your classroom, do you see students coming up that have more of an international view on things, or are they still staying very kind of looking out? Does that make sense?
Sure,
I feel like Americans stand and look out as opposed to kind of looking in a lot of ways,
yes.
Looking at the big picture.
I think in general in San Diego, you're still talking about a lot of students who are, you know, coming to school who are very American, wealthy, Southern California mindset, young, right? They tend to be, you know, have everything before them. They tend to be pretty American. But I'm seeing a growing increase. You know, a place like State has a lot of people who come across the border every day to class. And so you get a lot of, you know, Mexican, Latin American perspective.
Do you think the students that come up from Tijuana have that international perspective on things that
they have a different spin than people here do, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And especially in some of these, you know, social justice issues,
yeah, yeah.
They're going to hear something like the Gospel of Luke pretty darn
yeah.
differently. They do bring a different perspective. I'm also seeing more international students.
Hmm.
So I'm seeing more students from China, more students from the Middle East. I'm having a lot more Muslim students in classes on Christianity.
How do Muslim students, you think, how are they relating or understanding?
I think Francis, one of the things I loved, and again, I love his actions. His
yeah.
actions are amazing. And one of the things that he did, as you probably know, is when he went to wash the feet of
mm-hmm.
these prisoners, which
yeah,
was
yeah, yeah.
amazing,
yeah.
that he chose two who were Muslim, one male, one female
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Muslim, that he washed their feet.
Yeah.
This is remarkable. I mean, this is a real statement. This is a statement, and a statement that, again, he has good papal background for. Pope John Paul II had some wonderful statements about Islam, talking about how Islam, how they're worshiping of the same God, that we are siblings in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that I think Christians tend to reserve for Judaism in their attitudes, but that he was clearly extending to Islam. I think Pope Francis is already laying the groundwork for that, certainly.
So how do you think they're understanding? Are they relating?
I don't
Pope
know if
Francis?
They know.
Do they care? Is he even on the radar?
You know, I think that the language for Muslims right now is so fraught because in America, Islam has been so demonized and so misunderstood
yeah.
that I think that their relationship to the West and to Christianity is really is challenging. Now, I think that's part of the joy of having Islamic students in my class, both for Christians to see Muslims and to learn a little bit more about their tradition, even as small as a little bit,
yeah.
and for them to learn more about Christianity and realize that it's not anti-Islam. You know, they have, I don't know how much their vision of the West is, you know, fueled by the Crusades or by Western antagonism in modern times.
It's just so crazy to think that your vision of a culture would be fueled by something that happened when the Crusades.
The Crusades.
I mean, when
back,
was that?
Oh goodness! Starts
14,
you know 1095. And it's the preaching of the Crusade, and then 1099 is the capturing, and yeah. No,
I mean,
you're right. And then
nuts.
The stopping by the 1400s.
That is nuts.
1500s. I know.
To think that
I know.
Your vision of a culture would be based on something that happened 1,000 years ago.
Well, an even Christian view of the Crusades and Muslim view of the Crusades, frankly, are just wrong. The Crusades are not this horrible, demonized fight. Yes, you do have both sides going against each other in the name of religion, but there's actually more contact between them. I mean, they're living side by side.
Mm-hmm.
We have great primary source accounts. One of my favorite ones, this great extended primary source account by a Muslim author, a Syrian prince, who has buddies who are Templars.
Yeah,
he has
yeah.
friends who are Templars who he's hanging out with. And they're hanging out with him, and they're helping him out, and they're sharing stories. And you have, you know, Christians living over Muslim large populations that they're learning to deal with, bits of science, medicine. The sides are respecting each other. They're learning about one another's religions.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time, they're fighting against each other.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's way messier than, you know, people look at the Crusades and they say, oh, how horrible, people are killing each other in the name of religion, this
yeah,
horrible
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
I mean, the Crusades were a time of, they were that, no question.
Yeah.
But they also were a time of real connection.
But there was really no separation between the church and the government or anything.
No.
And that's the other thing I think a lot of Americans don't grasp.
No, they don't. They don't.
The rest of the world doesn't separate those things at all. I mean, we do sort of.
They don't.
In a way. And there's still even controversy about how much we can separate those two things.
Well, and how much we should.
And how much we should.
Certainly
definitely, you look at Mount Soledad. That's a perfect example whether or not.
Sure.
That cross should come down. That's
sure.
a discussion that's going to go on for decades. Probably.
Well, and our history in the colonial period is so intertwined with religion.
Yeah.
And so many of the founding fathers were so deeply religious, although odd religions in some case. these are very complex issues. And when I love teaching, I teach a survey of Christianity,
yeah.
and I think everybody's kind of like, "Wow, Christianity is so intertwined with history."
Yeah, yeah.
And of course it is.
Yeah.
And that's part of course, what the Pope inherits.
So when you teach these classes, is this a lot of times people see their own lives as being part of a bigger history?
They do.
A bigger world history? Most of the time, I think when students study history, it's kind of something that happened to somebody else in a way. It's not this
yeah.
personal first-person experience. Like, this is where I come from, kind of thing.
And I try.
And Americans don't see themselves as being part of a longer lineage at all.
They don't.
Oh, well, we're a young, we barely even have a culture, kind of thing, which I totally disagree with completely.
Agreed.
But they don't just don't see their relationship to this 2,000 year long
they
past.
They don't. And they're ignorant of this larger language, or not exposed to this larger language. And that's one of the great joys of teaching this stuff. And I teach a lot of Bible, and I teach a lot of history of Christianity. And students come in thinking that they have some sense of this, that they know what they're going to learn,
and
or what
you
to expect.
Mess them all up.
I do, and it's fun. And, you know, and it's, well, and it's great because I love the richness of these traditions.
Yeah, yeah.
I love how rich and messy the Bible
is. Has any student ever like freaked out and just changed religions in the middle of your class?
I'm sure they do.
You've never seen that happen?
You know, I hear about it after the fact sometimes.
Oh, okay.
And they come back to me, and you know, and some of them come back and like, you know, oh my gosh, you know, I'm suddenly going to church, and you know, I'm suddenly you know, I'm hanging out with my grandparents, and oh, you know, I've decided that I'm gonna, you know, be a minister. Yeah, I do get that.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you're gonna get that in general. It's religious studies.
Sure.
Right.
And then I also get ones who come and they're like, I can't believe I used to believe this. Forget it. Yeah. So you get a range.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd love to see if you cause anyone to totally just reevaluate their entire world perspective. Because that could change a worldview right there, you know.
I'm sure I do, and
when somebody comes in and you mess them all up with the truth of the grayness of this whole thing.
I would hope I do in some ways, in that knowledge should change us, right?
Yeah. I just think that's great that you're like, I hope I screw them up.
Well, I hope I take their worldview and enlarge it and challenge it.
Yeah.
And I would say that probably more of them become more religious than less. Which again, you know, again, as a person who loves religion, I would kind of hope that whether they become more Muslim, more Jewish, more Christian, more whatever, you know, if they're Protestant, if they suddenly become Catholic, if they're Catholic and they become Eastern Orthodox, that's all great. but even, I mean, what can I say? I'm fine, you know, if they're Protestant, they come in and they suddenly become atheist. That's life too. I mean,
if that's
what happens in their encounter of this material.
That was something else that the Pope brought up, was his statement on atheists.
That was amazing. No, that was very interesting to me.
And I kind of liked it because what it did in a lot of ways is it sparked a discussion about atheists and atheism. And for the people that I found that were really religious, it was like it bothered them. Because they felt like their reward, in a lot of ways, reward is how they saw it, was being taken in that these people who weren't doing it for that reason. They were just being good people for the sake of being good people.
Yes. And this Pope's actions and teachings, I think, are challenging everyone. And it's one of the things I personally love about him. Again, maybe it fits with my style of teaching. I love to get people to think
about messing everyone up.
He is messing with everyone.
Yeah.
In a beautiful way. And in a way that is very biblical. And in a way that is very much within the tradition of the church. And I love that he keeps changing every one of these discussions. So I think atheism, I think that many people who are within the religious tradition would want to look at atheism and want to say, you know, that somehow we're okay and somehow what you're doing is really messed up and wrong.
Yeah.
And I think, again, he kind of changed the conversation and he looked at them and said, you know, basically God loves you too and God has a plan for you too. And right now that's atheism. All right, we can work with that. And it's not that, I mean, at least that's how I kind of read those words that he was saying.
Yeah.
It's not that he's saying atheism's great. Let's all be atheists.
Yeah.
Because obviously he believes very strongly that the Christian God and the God of the Catholic Church is the way to go.
Yeah. He's the Pope.
He is the Pope, and you would hope for nothing less.
Yeah.
And he can't say that atheism is great, but he changes the discussion.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what he's done with so many things. With homosexuality, I love that what he's done is where everybody was wanting to point fingers and judge and make the church into a couple hot button issues, which of course we do way too much with our politics. That drives me crazy.
It's easy in a 30-second soundbite.
That's
what everyone's looking for.
It is.
That's the challenge when you're doing news about this Pope.
It is.
Is you can't just go, oh, here's 30 seconds on the Pope, and you understand everything. Doesn't
it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And frankly, he's not letting that work. I love that he's not giving us that choice.
He's very savvy.
He is. It goes back to that Jesuit piece.
Yeah.
But that he takes that piece where he takes, and I wish I had the exact quote, but he says, people who are gay, who are seeking God, who are of good action or good intent, it's that good part, I'm forgetting what it is, that who am I to judge? there's so many pieces of that that on the one hand he uses the word gay, which I think people get very interested in, that this is apparently no pope has done before. It's an interesting, you know, that he's acknowledging their own self-designation in a neutral sort of way.
Yeah.
But then he makes it and says, who am I to judge? So
everywhere, you're the Pope.
You're the Pope, exactly.
You're supposed to do this, right?
Well, exactly.
And it confused people.
Well, it did, because if the Pope can't judge, then who am I to judge?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think he's put it back on all of us.
Yeah.
And he's done so in a language that plays on the biblical language. For me, I couldn't help but hear the echoes of the woman caught in adultery, where Jesus' response is basically, you know, you who are without sin, cast the first stone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, he takes this issue. It's not that he's saying that this woman did right, but he changes the discussion and he says, you want to cast that stone?
Yeah.
You think you're okay? You think you're good? Mm-hmm. And again, I think he's changed the discussion. He's shifted it. And he has done so in a biblical way. He's done so in a way that has not changed the official position of the church.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he has completely changed it. And also he's done so in a way that is deeply compassionate to the many, many, many people who are homosexual, who are gay, who are in parishes, who maybe even are practicing as priests, and who really are seeking God.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been compassionate to them without in any way changing the rules of the church.
Yeah.
And he's doing this with so many different aspects. I think he's done so in a perhaps lesser way with women, where he said that women should have, you know, power in the church, that they have gifts that need to be exercised.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he hasn't then said that they need to be priests.
Yeah.
But he's actively looking for them to fill more roles using their gifts. What a wonderful biblical way to put this.
Yeah.
What a wonderful way that fits within the life of the church. And that does challenge things, again, on a worldwide stage. I mean, here in America, we might look at that and say, well, that's not nearly far enough.
Yeah.
But in so many of the countries that he is speaking to, women don't have a part in active life at all.
Anything.
In any form of leadership.
Yeah.
And so I think this is really radical.
They can't own homes. They can't do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think, I love how he keeps changing the discussion.
Yeah. What do you think his next big...
next big thing is to do?
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, I know he's going to Israel.
I was going to say, this is the one that I am most looking forward to. As soon as I read that, as soon as I encountered that, I was like,
yeah.
that here he is in May, I think, end of May, he proclaimed that he wants to go on pilgrimage to the Holy Land.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Israel, you bring up. He's clearly going to be encountering Jewish people.
Yeah.
And so what's going to be...
There's controversy there.
There is. And what's going to be his reaction and his relationship there? And then, oh my gosh, is he going to get in the midst of this Palestinian thing?
Yeah.
How is he not going to? This Pope, how is he not going to in some way, you know, embrace a Palestinian?
Yeah.
In, you know, some way, and Palestinians, as again people in the West may not know, there are a lot of Christians who have been Christians in Palestine all the way back.
Yeah.
How is he not going to be in the midst of that Palestinian Christian community that's going to be so eager to see him?
Of course.
Yeah. And then especially the one that I love, Eastern Orthodoxy, that Eastern Orthodox and the Catholic Church, they have a very messy history, of course. And of course, going back all the way back to, you know, early period, back to late antiquity, certainly 3rd, 4th, 5th century, the roots of it, but the Great Schism in 1054.
Yeah.
But Pope John Paul II was the first to go and actually visit a Greek Orthodox country, went to Greece, he celebrated, prayed with a patriarch. This Pope apparently was the first one to have a patriarch come to his installation.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
Yeah.
I did remember seeing that, and I pointed that out.
Yep.
Because a buddy of mine was marrying a Greek girl in Athens. And
great. Yep.
And it was a thing, because I'd been learning all about this. And
yeah.
You know, it was weird, because, you know, he was raised on the East Coast, very typical East Coast Irish Eastern Catholic.
Oh, wow, Irish Catholic.
Irish Catholic, very, and he met this girl in Europe, and now he's living in... Living the dream,
right?
In Paris, importing motorcycle parts for a living. I mean, I really feel bad for him.
Of course. And now you have to go visit him. Of course.
And now we get to go visit. But now he met this Greek girl who's Greek. Comes out of that Greek Orthodox tradition.
Of course, and that's a very big deal within the Greek
community. She's not very active.
Oh, really?
No. But her family is.
Yeah.
She couldn't. There's no way she was going to get married and not have a church wedding.
Sure.
And so he had to kind of navigate that relationship too.
Yeah.
Because they went back to Greece to get married.
Wow.
And the family well,
you,
has their
you marriage, marry Eastern Orthodox, you marriage, marry into the Greek family. There's no question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Spent a lot of time in Greece. I love Greece, but yes.
It's an experience.
It is.
And he's had to kind of come to terms with that.
It is.
In a lot of ways, it's a very different style of family.
Very different style of family, very different style of everything, and it's gorgeous. Parapulioreo, it's beautiful.
Yeah, but it's challenging. But
it is.
I mean, they're doing great. But so for him to personally navigate that, I remember seeing that, and then seeing that, I was like, was it Greek Orthodox?
Yeah.
With the hat and the locks and everything, it's just
The long hair and the beards and the
quite a statement.
It is. Although for a very long time the Catholic Church has had what's called Eastern Rite Catholic, who follow every aspect of the liturgy and much of the theology of the Eastern Orthodox Church, but are Catholic. Oriental Catholics sometimes referred to as well. This Pope, interestingly,
which is a reference to the Orient, which is Greece, Turkey, kind of a little bit of North Africa, not Asia.
Exactly,
I have to explain that to people.
No, good point.
A lot of people don't know that. Yep. They think Oriental is just a pejorative.
And it's such a messy term these days. We scholars try so desperately not to use it after Saeed and all that stuff. But yeah, another piece I gather with this with him when he was in Argentina, one of his friends was Eastern Rite Catholic, I gather. And so he actually went and was observing. He celebrated the Divine Liturgy.
Yeah.
So he actually knows a fair bit about Eastern Orthodox worship. So personally, I can't wait to see what happens when he then encounters Eastern Orthodoxy. There, I think there is lots of language for healing, for transformation, for really radical things to happen. Things that are truly newsworthy within the life of the church.
Will it be like what he's doing now in the sense of just changing the perspective, like what you were saying, and kind of throwing the language back onto us, or will it be actual kind of revolutionary action?
It could be truly revolutionary, because in this case, I think there is nothing limiting him. There is nothing in terms of the life of the church. There are no good reasons other than the long, long history, which granted is a good reason, but there is no good reason for the separation. I think, to give you an idea of what you have to push to get a good reason, that the Pope, from an Eastern Orthodox perspective, is the Bishop of Rome.
Yeah.
And for them, he is one of five patriarchs.
I'll be going, if you can stay longer, but you have to pay attention. Well, I have to go up from there's three doorways, two doors, three doorways. Make sure you go out on the right hand side. Any of those doorways, the right hand side, just the right hand side, make sure it's shut up.
Okay, we'll make sure it's shut.
We will. Thank you very much. but yeah, that he's supposed to be Bishop of Rome. And he is regarded as the greatest of the bishops, but kind of the greatest among equals.
Yeah.
So the idea of the papacy is a problem for them in and of itself. Now, in some ways, he's been using that language. He's been wanting to re-empower bishops. He's been de-emphasizing, in some ways, the kind of sovereignty, if you will, of the Pope in some of his actions. But you have to push that hard to find something that's a real division between the two. There's no good historic reason. And the church has a... I think it was 1999, the agreement that was made with the Lutherans, where truly history, groundbreaking, that the main body of the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church removed their excommunications of one another, and the Catholic Church pronounced that salvation came through grace and faith alone, which was, of course, Luther's position.
Yeah.
That was radical.
Yeah.
That was absolutely radical. So I think that's an aspect where he does have an opportunity. Another one, and I don't know that he will. Really radical change if it came. But again, the language exists in the language of the church. One of the many things people have been pushing for, homosexuality, women as priests. The other one, of course, is married priests.
Yeah.
And this one, I think, has been being pushed for a long time. This one, if he chose to, he actually could start overturning. Because there is language for that within the life of the church. Celibate clergy is only since the Gregorian reforms, Gregory VII, period kind of 1073, 1095, granted a long time ago, but not from the perspective of the life of the church.
It's a geological term.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was done because they were drawing on monastic life, there were problems with lay investiture, problems with the church intertwined with the politics of the world. There were lots of reasons to have celibate clergy. Are those reasons, do they still apply today? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's at least the opportunity for him to open the conversation. I would be shocked if he did any of these decisions unilaterally. They would be done with a synod of bishops. They would be done with a gathering. They would be done with a lot of prayer and reflection.
So once he kind of convenes this synod of bishops, is that when we start to anticipate, start to foreshadow something big happening?
We could see some real changes. And I gather, he actually, another one of the interesting announcements is that he's going to have a synod of bishops, I think, to reflect on some issues affecting modern marriage in the modern world.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be divorce could be an issue.
Divorce, I think, could be a big one. Yeah. How do we treat divorced people in the church, in the life of the church? And I think that the Catholic Church has not been particularly great on that.
Yeah.
And
that's the other thing I think a lot of people have to kind of keep in mind, that the church moves in slowly.
It does.
And
it does.
It's not, and it's hard for Americans to understand, because America and the United States moves quickly.
We move so fast, and we expect things should move fast, and even faster than they do.
Yeah. And so, you know, even when you're talking about the sex scandals and all that happened within the church,
sure.
It's not necessarily that those scandals, that those acts happened because these priests were celibate. They're no more or less likely to be pedophiles if they're priests or not.
Right.
There's no correlation there. But it's the way the church handled it, which, though, was the way this kind of thing was handled universally across society.
It was.
Up through maybe the 70s, even as late as the 80s. I would say that's just the way the society handled those things. And now that's all, of course, changed. But we did that change very quickly.
We did.
And
the church changes
gradually. And the church has it to catch up with it.
It does.
And that's the challenge they're having now.
We believed at the time that, you know, you get people counseling and that they then get better from it, or it changes, or they can somehow. Yeah, and they were doing that. They were following those practices.
Yeah, but they weren't keeping up with the rest of sort of American culture and the way American legal system is moved.
Exactly, and which is then said, keep them away from children, remove them at all costs.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is, I think, that perspective on how the church acts within the United States has always been continually kind of misunderstood.
Yeah. Well, and they also had the challenge of the confessional and the power of the confessional. And
what that really means.
Yeah.
I mean, then you enter into a whole different argument. Like, what does forgiveness mean? Forgiveness doesn't mean you forget what happened and kind of put yourself in a position to let it happen again. That would just be, that's called stupidity.
It is.
Yeah.
And forgiveness is a way of making sense of the sin and a renewed relationship with God, but it doesn't mean that, you put yourself back in that
situation.
You don't
put yourself back in that. That's just stupid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those debates go on, I think, within our culture, that the church doesn't keep up with in the same way. Or even the debate, they don't necessarily keep up with the what's going on in the debate.
And
that's kind of a problem, too, because you end up with, maybe at the parish level you don't have that, right? Because parish priests are involved and they kind of know what's going on, but then the higher up the ladder you go, they're not hearing what's happening down below.
Yeah.
But that's common with anybody in any sort of high position, and they kind of get out of touch.
It is, and hierarchies move slowly. I personally, as a person who, again, I'm so rooted in the early period, I love teaching the history of all this. To me, so much of the beauty of the church, and particularly the beauty of the Catholic Church, is that it is so deeply rooted, that it changes so slowly. And in a world, in America,
because you like the history.
I do, and I know it, and that they have this ballast. They have their feet in this history.
Mm-hmm.
And also in other culture, in the world.
Yeah.
Not just America. And I think, you know, Protestant churches so often become so localized, so small in their view, theologically, historically, culturally. And granted, that's not true of all Protestant traditions either. They're incredibly diverse.
My grandmother from Belfast would totally agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I mean, in some ways, I should say my own tradition is Lutheran. I have lots of experience in the Protestant church. I don't mean to harsh on the Protestant tradition here. My point instead is to emphasize what I think is beautiful about the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Which
is
the way...
I'm just making fun.
No, quite all right. Yeah, exactly.
I'm just teasing it.
And I love... Personally, again, studying religion, I love the beauty of each of these traditions. Mm. Part of the beauty of the Catholic Church is that it does move so slowly, and it allows it to challenge things. So like Pope John Paul II, Pope Benedict, they had wonderful challenges of secularism, relativism. They could really challenge the world on these issues and do so in a very deeply rooted language. So for instance, Pope Benedict, and I know not everybody got his stuff, I loved that he looked at things like reason, our infatuation with reason. We are in love with reason. We think that reason is everything. We're all, you know, totally head over heels with the Enlightenment, Descartes, and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. We seem to think it's, you know, the answer to everything, right? And he looks at that and he says, reason without faith is utterly useless and meaningless. And to be fair, I mean, he's drawing on Anselm, he's drawing on scholasticism, he's drawing on all the stuff that created the Enlightenment in the first place.
Yeah.
And that founded the universities.
Which is kind of ironic.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And he looks at it and he says that when you look at reason without faith, you have truncated reason in a way that is meaningless.
Yeah.
And so he was kind of challenging everybody in a very intellectual, very academic way to look back at the language of faith and not just throw it out. And, you know, I think, again, the church has the ability to do that.
Yeah.
Just as, and I love... Pope Francis, I love his speeches too. I think that, again, people take these snippets. He is so quotable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you have to put them back in their context.
Yeah, context is always hard.
He has a wonderful, wonderful message that I highly recommend. This one that he did that was a New Year's message for the Day of Peace when he talks about fraternity, brotherhood. And so his message to the world is that we should all see each other as brothers, that this is the way forward to peace. This is also his vision for how you deal with these economic problems, that we should see each other as brothers. So on the one hand, you can look at that from American perspective. Yeah, brotherhood, great, let's get behind this, right? But of course, he's going to reframe that, and he's going to say, yes, brotherhood, but first of all, brotherhood rooted in a biblical story, rooted in, you know, Adam and Eve, created in the likeness of God, rooted in the sin of Cain and Abel. This is where it can go wrong. But then also, brotherhood for him is meaningless if we don't have a transcendent father. What does relationship look like? How can we be brothers if we don't have something above us? Something binding us together in family. And so, again, I love that this happens, that on the one hand, he uses a language that I think people would love, brotherhood.
Yeah.
Treat your brother nicely.
Yeah, yeah.
I think every atheist, everybody will get behind that. They'll say, wow, this is a great language. Let's quote this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then he is understanding this in this language of familial transcendent fatherhood. You know, he's using a language then that, again, is changing. It's that long view that he's seeing all this in. I should let you, I'm going in lots of directions.
No, it's great. I was just saying that we've been doing this for over an hour now.
We should wrap up soon. It does fly. Yeah, yes, yeah. It's the danger of being a professor and loving to talk and having a great conversation partner.
It's the topic, too.
It is.
I think this guy's just...
He's amazing.
He's one interesting thing happening after another that it doesn't get lost. Whereas Benedict, I think, got lost in kind of his academic... Came off as very academic and very impersonable, but it could be just because he's German. And
when he was hard to quote, and when he was quoted, people didn't get it.
Yeah.
And I think you had to be so richly academically trained to possibly understand what he was doing.
Yeah.
He was speaking to a very small audience.
Yeah. And Francis just doesn't do that. He's in the mud.
He is.
And
he is, as Francis would have been.
Yeah, of course. Which is easy to it's easy to approach him. And everybody is, I think, paying attention to him more than they just paid attention to popes.
And I love, he approaches other people. He I mean, these
is he
cold calls.
Out? Do you think he's, yeah, the cold, the message with the nuns?
With the nuns, it's great.
That cracks me up.
It's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, we all did that story.
That's great.
But is he sneaking out? The rumors, is he sneaking out at night?
I hope so.
Yeah,
part
yeah.
Of me
everyone likes
that,
but
it's
it just
great
a
story.
Rumor? It's a great
I
story.
I don't know. And of course, the Vatican has to deny it for safety reasons, among other things. It's totally fitting. I mean, again, I think that you said, you know, he hasn't done anything, you know, out of character yet.
Uh-huh.
Look at his history. This guy, you look at him all the way
through. But his character is being out of character, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
He has always been this way.
Yeah, yeah.
And
he took the metro and took the bus and all that.
He did.
That was the thing my wife loved. Just getting was talking to his cousins and his family, and they were they were over the moon.
Oh,
they were super excited.
Yeah,
you know, the Pope's brother-in-law. You know,
and these are very simple people, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, they're all educated.
Sure,
They're all, I would call them kind of middle class, uneducated.
Yeah,
people. They're all smart, of course, but they're all educated, middle class ish.
Right.
People, whatever that means in Argentina.
Right.
But, you know, they were run-of-the-mill human beings.
And of course, just like over the moon. I'm sure they were proud of him when he became cardinal, and they thought that's what he was going to stop.
Right.
Nobody thought he was going to. He's the Pope now? How did this?
You know? Well, obviously he didn't even expect it. I mean, I gather, you know, he turned 75.
How
he dutifully
weird
turned
would that
in
be?
His
your
retirement.
The Pope? What do you do? You know, it was just funny. You know, they were just, you know, of course they were, and it was early on, so they were taking calls, right?
Right.
I'm sure they've stopped that.
I'm sure they have.
Change all their phone numbers and.
Although maybe
security.
Not.
You never know. You never know. You know.
They probably had to.
Probably security-wise, I bet it becomes.
I'm sure.
Weird being the Pope's sister, right? Because he has a sister, I believe.
Yeah. And how do you... I know he has one living family member, and I don't remember if it's a brother or sister. Of his siblings.
Yeah, yeah.
At least one.
I think it's his sister, and then she's still married.
Okay.
And then he's got nephews and nieces, and I mean, I'm sure everybody's trying to claim relationship to him.
I think he has a divorce in the family as well, which is part of why that divorce issue gets so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so he doesn't come from this kind of high...
No.
And he doesn't come from a kind of a papal tradition in a lot of ways either, because his family wasn't particularly religious.
Yeah.
They were all surprised that he even became a priest.
Right. Well, and I mean, he had an interesting path to priesthood.
Yeah.
You know, that God kind of claimed him of sorts, and he tells great stories about that.
And then, you know, to be a Jesuit, the amount of study and education that goes into that. And he's got, I think, I want to say 2 PhDs, and I don't know what they're in. I'm almost positive one of them's theology, but I'm not sure.
I remember
sure.
He was studying for his dissertation. I know that he has not seen, I believe he has not seen as a theologian in the same way that John Paul II or Benedict were.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what that means.
I don't know what his credentials are, his academic credentials are, but
to
be a Jesuit, you need serious academic.
You do. Oh, you do. And
it takes 20 years on that path.
And granted, Benedict was an academic among academics. I mean, he was the kind of academic that all of us academics look at and say, wow. I mean,
smart
he was,
guy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, I love actually, I don't remember the quote was from, but I gather that Pope Francis, one of his quotes was he said that, you know, when he became Pope, that how could he be any different? That, you know, he's an old man, that if he tried to do anything different, he just looks silly.
Yeah.
That he's going to basically be, you know, how can he change his stripes sort of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he hasn't at all.
Yeah.
He's exactly the same person he was.
Yeah, and that's what I think people are surprised by, but in a lot of ways you shouldn't be, because
that's who he's always been.
Benedict didn't change his stripes at all.
He didn't.
The slightest.
And neither did John Paul II, I think. Although no one knew what they were getting because he was so young at the time.
Yeah.
And he was Pope for so long.
Yeah.
The other thing I think is very interesting with him is so he hasn't changed at all. Hasn't changed in the least. Where was I going? Come on, brain. That's what I get for talking to
Nerd alert.
My brain skipped. Okay,
okay,
we'll switch topics.
Well, whatever.
But,
I'm trying to wrap it up.
You're trying to wrap it up. You're
trying to wrap it up.
I guess in terms of wrap up, the only things I haven't said, which I really would love to make sure I mention, are personally I find, you know, here I am as a religious studies scholar, right?
Yeah.
That I know so much of the history of the church. I know so much of the background. I feel like I should know what to expect. Part of what I love about this Pope is he does keep surprising me.
Yeah.
And he keeps challenging me. He keeps challenging me to look at the world a little differently. And I think he's doing that to everyone. People in the Catholic Church, people who are, you know, established within the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, as well as parishioners, but also people outside of the Catholic Church. And I think it's part of what's so refreshing about this Pope, and that when he does something like embrace this person with all of these skin lesions and, you know, this disease, disfiguring disease, it's so very biblical, so very Christ-like, so very Francis-like.
Yeah.
And yet, how many of us, I mean, we all have to pause. Would we do that? And what would that look like for us? And I think that so many of his actions, every time he keeps doing these things, he surprises, he challenges. I'm kind of hoping he keeps doing it. I'm kind of excited to see what comes next.
Yeah, yeah, what's going to happen in May?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's going to happen in May? What's going to happen when he gets these bishops together?
Yeah.
What's the next startling thing he's going to do?
Yeah.
How's he going to react to somebody who's Muslim that's going to surprise all of us? Is he going to, I mean, I think already the economic thing, the, you know, is he going to come out even further against capitalism? And what would that look like?
Yeah.
Could or will he change the role of women in some real way? That is, again, within the life of the church and within the history of the church, but would be radical.
Yeah.
It's interesting times.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.